So if the mind is to do us any good, we have to appoint it as prime minister of our lives, not as a ruler, but as one of the cabinet of advisors. And when we break the rules which our mind has been instructed to give us, then we must repent and do something about it instead of changing the subject. If we can do some of these things, then we will show that we are disciplined people. This was the concept beneath the philosophy of Confucius. Confucius declared that the human being is separated from the animal simply by the intellectual capacity to think, and that the human being who thinks wisely is the superior person. And in the course of time, this superior person, increasing in wisdom and fulfilling the needs of the wise content in himself, can go into the unknown future with a good hope. If we assume that the superior person is one who is above performing inferior actions, then we must admit that Confucius was very right, that he did have the answer to the whole thing, that the answer was not simply in abstract wisdom and learning. It was forever in the individuals living on the highest level of his own understanding. And this level is much higher than we suspect. It may be that at first we have to work a little with the level of understanding of someone who is wiser than ourselves. But we do it only in order that we may also attain wisdom. Now, all over the world, we go to people when we have problems. These people may be religious counselors, they may be a psychologist, psychiatrist, or one type or another of inspiring guidance. We therefore go to them and pay them to do our thinking for us, because we find in when we study it carefully that we are not capable of a separate look at ourselves. We are so tangled up in our own prejudices that we have to go to a third party to untangle us. Well, this is really not necessary, except perhaps in very serious and immediate cases. The individual who is all wound up in a situation has the power to unwind himself if he does something about it. But if he simply sits and watches his commercials on television, he will never unwind himself. He is wasting the time that he needs to work out solutions for his own dispositional problems. It is necessary for him, therefore, to give the time and attention to matters directly involved in solving his problem. Well, he may want to read a book or two on it, if he can get a good book. If the book caters to him, however, he better throw it away. He must get a book that demands more of him than he normally wants to give. It must be a book that challenges him to recognize his own mistakes and not pass them off on other people. But if he does have a gradual recognition that he can't live with himself the way he is, he will not come to the erroneous conclusion that the answer is to forget himself, and by forgetting himself, bury himself in non-essential, non-productive avocational activities such as watching television. It is necessary for him to get at his own nature. And creativity is partly the process of creating a better self within him, a self which he can be proud of, a self in which he will gain the recognition of other people who are worth recognizing him. Now, it's an interesting fact, however, that I've noticed, namely that a person who has made some of these adjustments is not only recognized by others who have made similar adjustments, but is recognized also very generously by people who have made no adjustments but wish they could. Therefore, a person who has disciplined himself is also admired by the undisciplined. He becomes a stronger person. He becomes a human being in a world of beasts. He becomes capable of gaining the respect of those with whom he comes in contact. His reward is to improve his recognitions. His reward is to be called upon to help other people and to have a life full of useful activities. So there are rewards for taking hold of these problems. Actually, also, as people get a little older and not quite so vital and so active, it becomes more important for them to recognize the realization of this problem of self-discipline. Unless there is some real reason why an individual cannot take an active part in society, he should take such a part. He should find ways to do it. He can join senior citizen activities. He can become part of group thinking and group action. But most of the time, the older person has a tendency to live in a kind of nostalgia. He is inclined to be neurotic. He is inclined to feel self-pity. He is inclined to think he is neglected or ignored or that life has passed over him. Worst of all, perhaps, with these older people, there is an adjustment to be made which they have never thought of and which could be tremendously important. And that is that to be comfortable and happy in life, each person has to be contemporary. Then we reach that point in life when everything we like and know has faded away, and we live in a world of strangers and can no longer find the consolations that helped us in youth. Then we are in the presence of a great challenge. We must not try to live in 1950 if we are in 1980. We have to find contemporary activities. Now, we may say these contemporary activities are a constant offense to us. They can be, and many of them are. But whether they are offensive or defensive, we have to accept them. We have to recognize that there is no value, no virtue, no fulfillment in blocking ourselves against the changes that take place in society. This does not mean we have to do anything wrong. It doesn't mean we have to practice anything we don't believe in. But we have to live in a world in which we understand why other people have changed, recognizing the pressures, circumstances, and forces that have moved them into a different relationship with life. In other words, we must accept them and understand them even though we don't agree with them. Otherwise, we gradually lock ourselves in a world much too small for us. And we find one by one the remaining persons whom we do know slipping away until we are alone in a generation which has no basic roots in our thinking or our time. Moving as we do today at a terrific pace, it is necessary for every individual to be constantly contemporary. The difficulty is usually that the person drifts along as he was until his last friend is gone, and then he suddenly feels this terrific need for change. But if he started in the beginning by watching, participating in, and studying the values of the better people who are rising around him, they're always good people, he will gradually learn how to evaluate the changes which he may not agree with, but with which he can make a satisfactory and constructive adjustment. He can live without retiring into a world that is not real. This also occurs in cases of persons born in other countries or who migrate to countries which were not their own and find gradually that they are alone. The only way to get out of aloneness is to grow, to outgrow it by enriching the life, enriching the consciousness, and having new dedications by means of which life continues to the end to be an interesting and dramatic experience. Otherwise, these things get to be too difficult. Now, there are also other groups of people who are confronted with this problem, and those are the ones who, for one reason or another, are beginning to experience physical deficiencies. They are not physically able to get along as well as they did. Now, there's a philosophy behind all this which most people don't think of at all. The first two-thirds of life should prepare the person for the last third. By the time we reach the period where we can't do all the things we used to do, we should have so enriched our inner lives that we have plenty of activity internal in ourselves. We should be able to adjust easily to the limitations of energy. and accept it as inevitable, but not gradually develop hatreds, jealousies, and a variety of neurotic pressures simply because we're getting older. Actually, in most instances, if we realize it, senility begins with lack of dynamic internal incentive. The individual who has nothing to live for lives worse and worse until finally they disappear. So in now all these things, we are living vicariously in a world which we are either accepting or rejecting, but making very little effort to truly understand. We also have made very little effort to adjust our lives to the capacities that we have to find satisfaction in the achievements that are possible to us, and are also constantly alert to new things. We must remain ever alert. And this alertness has much to do with the creative instinct in ourselves. Now, we have an indoctrination that we've got to get over some way. And this fatalistic indoctrination is that if we place it at in the front row of our emotional and mental activity, fear. This is an age in which we are more or less constantly in a state of fear. And this fear, such as it is drummed into us on every hand. There is hardly a newspaper we pick up which does not contain something that frightens us. The same is true as news reports on TV, or the news or the plays that are put on. And nearly always there is a great conflict with evil popping up everywhere, with horror, misery, and crime, as accepted as the normal state of the human being. With this type of situation, fear is inevitable. The individual gradually is afraid to be himself. He is afraid to continue the activities that he formerly had because he is constantly in the presence of danger. Well, this is real in some conditions. There is no doubt about it. We can't completely ignore it. But on the other hand, we can also rise above fear. We can rise to a degree of rational care. We can do those things which are reasonable to do that will protect us. We can stop being foolish or doing things which open us to trouble. Most people who are in trouble have in some way lowered the resistance in themselves which could have protected them from difficulties. But with the fear constantly there, the mind goes into a kind of whirlwind. Fear dominates every other consideration. And the one thing we haven't learned as yet is to be afraid of the negative part of ourselves. There's where most of our troubles originate. Our compromises with principles are the things that get us into physical difficulties. We should be afraid more for our own conduct than we are for the situations that may arise from it. We have today millions of persons who are alcoholics. Not one of them really wants to kill anyone or be killed, but nothing seems to make enough difference. There is no dominant desire to change. Why? Because life is empty. Because it's the only way they have of forgetting themselves or getting over some disagreement or finding a use for a useless life. These things must be corrected in their causes, and the only way to correct them is to discipline the inner life, to put something in there that makes us want to live because we are useful to others, and not merely because we want to forget our own miseries. The misery factor is being dramatized every day. Internationally, we are in a state of constant agitation. Politically, we're involved all the time in the ups and downs of policy. And all these things cause us to come to the conclusion that life is insecure, that the world is hardly worth living in, and that practically the only happy person is the one who doesn't think at all. Now, this type of thinking is getting more or less prevalent, or the assumption that no matter what happens to anyone else, we'll be in trouble for the rest of our lives. We have to get over this by leadership over self, by leadership over our own tendencies, to get rid of certain fears by replacing them, not by saying that trouble can't exist, not by denying the conditions, but by recognizing the value of self as a leader out of dilemma. That in one way or another, the inner life can be the most protecting thing that we have. There are laws that govern human conduct. There are laws that deal with the relationships of life. And if the individual really keeps the rules, in most cases the rules will keep him. It is where we stagger around without reason or anything else, in a world of other people staggering around without reason, that we are constantly in the face of crime and degeneracy. Now, we can't change it all, but we can make every possible effort to get hold of ourselves, to find ways to make ourselves available to good. I watch quite a deal because of the things I'm interested in. I watch reports from all around the world about things that are happening to people. And if you sit down and relax and think a minute, you can't help but see some very wonderful things happening. You can see that some of the hopes that we have are being realized, that people are trying harder than they ever have before, that various causes that have been forgotten and neglected for ages are coming into focus. One of the most important discoveries, I think, of modern time is the realization that materialism is dying. And the is doubting and the scoffing and the failure to recognize the spiritual needs of man is not fashionable anymore. This type of thinking is gone. In the emergency, we find, in spite of everything, our hopes drift back and up to the spiritual sources of ourselves. This we see all over the world, people now struggling desperately to regain faith and at the same time to adjust personal living to the confusion of the day. Another situation that seems to be very prominent today is the advancements that we have in education. We do not hear about them very much, but all over the world, major colleges and universities are studying esoteric matters that 25 years ago would have been called lunacy. We are also doing the same thing in many fields that we did a few years ago with acupuncture. When it arrived, it was a superstition of the ancient heathen Chinese. Today, it isn't that anymore. It's being used all over the world to help people to do things and get better. Little by little, the esoteric and metaphysical ideals that have been locked within many of us for years are gaining recognition. We are coming more and more to be recognized as the last frontier of defense against a metaphysical, mystical, or scientific chaos. The time has come gradually. I watch the papers, and I watch the foreign journals, and every day almost, somebody does something really great, something really unselfish, and something that really counts. But of course, it is drowned in a mass of wreckage that we am inclined to believe. But everywhere things are moving forward. And about the poorest place to sit to watch a move is in front of the tube. Because it's there that it's going to stay as it is to the bitter end, apparently. But the bitter end isn't as far off as we think. Most of the great television circuits are in serious difficulties. They have discovered for some unknown reason, they can't understand why, should object to 20 commercials an hour. They can't understand why we are no longer fascinated with the 15th or 20th remake of some second-rate detective story. They can't understand why we're getting tired of these woe-begone characters doing things that we wouldn't allow any relative of ours to do. And we are forced to take into our homes the shadows of people we would never want to know. The studio can't understand this. They think that it remains necessary to get down as low as possible in order to control the audience. They figure if there's anything constructive, the people will turn it off. And as a result of this attitude, people are turning it off anyway. They're getting awfully tired of it. Complaints are going into the studios every day. And gradually, the one thing that counts is going to happen. The set will be turned off. And then we will begin to find that the people have the deciding voice in the entertainment they're going to receive. But if they're all asleep themselves, why should they wake up at all? Why should we ask for something better if we don't care? Or if we tolerate the way it is? Or whether anything is better than to think? With this type of attitude, we were going to have the same problem, always. But the programs are in trouble. The stations are in trouble. And little by little, it is becoming obvious that the audience is not satisfied. And more and more, it is supporting independent theatrical projects. We are tired of a programming that is intended for people who do not think and do not want to think. These people are getting fewer. For one reason, the death rate is very heavy among them. The less we think, the more vulnerable we are to everything. We are finding more and more that this type of a program approach is just wrong. So, out of this, we can do a little thinking. We can do more and more of the disciplining, not only of our own minds, but of our acceptances of the corruptions of society. We not only can turn off these things, we can turn off advertising that is false, we can refrain from luxuries we can't afford, we can watch more carefully the sales appeals of other people, and we can realize the fact that we were not brought here for the purpose of trying to be happy by wasting money. It's coming. World pressures, circumstances are gradually emphasizing the need for intelligence. And as time goes on, this need is going to become increasingly great, and it is up to the individual to build his mind up so he can handle it when it comes. We don't want to be caught today with minds as they are now, because most people are not thinking, and they're not caring, or they're disappointed. Or if they have any thoughts at all, they're keeping them to themselves. But this is changing, and we must prepare for it. There is a world coming that is more intelligent, more forthright, more honorable, and more incentive-burdened than we realize. We need incentives, but the greatest incentive we have is to make our own present condition endurable, which it is not for many people. Our suicide rate is up simply because people have nothing to live for. They are simply hurt all the time. Well, once you've been hurt a few times, you either give up or else you decide that it's time to use the faculties that nature and deity provided to help us get over hurts. We do not have to give in to the misfortunes that surround us. It is perfectly possible to outgrow them. So, this is one of our key words today. There are things we have to outgrow. One is the belief in wealth. Another is the belief in war. Still another is the belief that other people can do our thinking for us. We are going to gradually have to outgrow that part of ourselves which is incapable of taking care of us. We are depending upon immature faculties to live a mature life. So we must develop and mature those faculties. We've got to build within ourselves a human being, fully aware of its origin and destiny, fully capable of leading its body and its emotions in the way in which they should go. This is, in the Jungian psychology, the teacher. The teacher in ourselves, the teacher that carries in it the whole burden, perhaps, of many hundreds of lives that we have lived before, the teacher that is submerged but is the grand old person, the old master, who has been in us and will be in us as long as we exist. It is the call upon this inner superiority, this inner maturity, to help us fight against the immaturity of our conscious daily procedures. The teacher image within ourselves can lead us to the perfection of a way of life suitable for our own needs. Its voice is rather weak, that's true, and it is often battered down by the pressure of appetites and desires, but the voice of the teacher is there. And gradually we come to realize that the potential of this redemption in ourselves is always available to us. We are not living to the fullness of ourselves so that there's nothing else we can do. We are not all we can be. We are very far down on the list for things that we can be. We are capable of a growth beyond our wildest imagination. We are capable of being much more than we've ever dreamed that we could be. But for some unknown reason, due largely to environmental pressure, we have denied that this could be true. We assume that we can't be anything except what we are, when in reality we can be almost anything that we will earn by our own personal integrities. So somewhere in our own present day is the being of tomorrow, the self in us, as it will be in a better world and in a larger theater of action. And it's there, ready to be built up, to be educated, to be released into expression, and to take command of conduct. And somewhere, the sorrow of living, the pressures, despondencies, and frustrations of daily experiences are going to force us to grow. We have nothing else we can do. We can say we can go into dry rot and die, but that isn't the end of anything. We have to face a future which can never be taken away and which can end only in achievement. We can resist achievement as long as we want to, and we will resist it. But in the end, we have to grow because there's no other way to go. Anything that looks like an escape is an illusion. Anything that promises that we can be happy in spite of ourselves is wrong. We can only be happy because of ourselves. And we can only be happy because our happiness is based upon an integrity in which we keep the rules of life and share the best that we know with all of those we come in contact with. All of this is part of an experience that we have to face sometime, probably sitting in front of a television screen. We have to decide what we're going to do. We have to decide how we're going to use this thing. We're going to have to say, I know there is going to be a certain type of program. It's going to be very horrible. I can hardly wait for it to come. We're going to have to change that and say, I think it's going to be horrible. I'm not going to turn it on. Little by little, we have to censor our own entertainment. It may come out that in the end, by censorship, we will have two or three programs a week that we really feel we want to see. If that's the case, that's the type of thing we want to use with the television set. Anything we don't want and we know we shouldn't see, we have to turn off. And as time goes on, we will find that we can turn off with one easy motion. It's very easy to just turn that dial and it goes off. But behind this one easy motion, there has to be the development and growth within ourselves by which this motion becomes a solution of something and not a frustration. We have to turn it off because we want something better, not because we simply are tired of what we're seeing. It has to be something more positive. And I understand from rumors that come along that there are plans for the development of television outlets suitable for thinkers, for people who really want to grow, who are tired of the same old thing. Now, this doesn't mean that all of these programs have to be dynamically religious or hopelessly and miserably educational. They can be very happy programs, but they can be happy because they deal in realities. They can be happy because happiness is something that's contagious if it is true and reasonable. It can, however, relieve us from all this misrepresentation and this conditioning of attitudes, which is contrary to the common good. So we are really always on the verge of something better. We are ready to demand something better. There is never a time in life in which the voice of the people is not heard, because the voice of the people is the foundation of the economic structure of society. What the people won't buy won't be made. What people do not want to pay that much for will come cheaper. And that which the individual says, "I'm tired of this stupid type of thing," will bring an end to this type of stupidity. We can have what we want. But in order to have it, we must discipline ourselves. We must have the courage to turn it off rather than consider it's better than nothing. We have to constantly watch our own level of censorship. And in place of these outside ways of forgetting ourselves, we must discover inside ways of remembering ourselves correctly. We have to gradually become self-sustaining in the fact that we are constantly searching for values that will support our integrities. If we make life a great adventure, we do not need foolish adventures manufactured by people. If we recognize life as a magnificent experience, we don't have to worry about second-rate drama. If we recognize that everything we need for happy internal is already available, but in order to use it, we are going to have to stand against the common practice of doing nothing. It is perfectly possible for a person to have a good entertainment pattern, a good reading pattern, and a good working pattern. And it is also possible to gradually interpret the wisdom of the ages into the common things we do. It is perfectly possible to recognize the family, the office, the friendship, and the nation as levels of life within a system of discipline. That perhaps it is in this common way that the disciplines of the ancient mysteries have come down to us. Those were given in old times, including physical dangers, in the grottos and caverns under the great temples. Today, these disciplines are being given to us in the marketplace. They are being given to us in the office, in the home, in all the institutions that we sustain, in the policies by which nations are dominated. These things are disciplines of one kind or another. And the great discipline is the individual who can remain true to his principles while these things are happening, and will find ways of having a full and rich life without compromising principles to waste time. It is, therefore, very easy for persons who have interests, who secretly or at least quietly believe in the larger and more important values of living, to gradually change their focus, to turn on what they know is good, turn off what they know is not good, and also to stop complaining, recognizing that regardless of whether they're watching or something or not watching, their own inner life is a full and magnificent experience for them. There is the great romance. There is the eternal love story, the love of the human soul for God. These things, however, can be temporalized. They can be brought down to the common facts of living, so that in every way, life is not just simply a burden or a routine. It is a drama. It is a romance. It is a series of wonderful happenings, which are wonderful if we understand them and miserable if we don't. And also that out of every misery can come a greater strength and a greater courage to meet the future with a good hope. If we get these thoughts more or less firmly fixed in mind, we will not be destitute for entertainment if we are no longer inclined to watch murder, rape, and mayhem. We do not need to be constantly reminded of the weaknesses of human nature in order to grow. If we want to understand weaknesses, we've got our own. We can create a situation just as dramatically negative as what we're watching. We're full of faults, making mistakes every 5 minutes. But at the same time, our mistake story has a happy ending. whereas most of those which were presented to us end only in further misery. So if we want to really have a great history, we can study our own inner lives. If we want a great theater, we can be both the audience and the cast. If we want any of the inner understandings which make for philosophy, mysticism, and so forth, they're all available inside of ourselves. The only thing we've got to do is bring it out. And we bring it out by dedication, gaining strength in the inner life, just as the athlete gains it by daily discipline. By the proper mental, emotional disciplines, we can become healthy individuals in terms of our minds, our emotions, our hearts, and our jobs. These are the things we've got to work for. And if it means that we must do it, we can, with one quick twist to the wrist, get rid of most of the corruptions of society and face the fact that these are imaginary corruptions. We've got plenty of real ones. We don't have to build them up that way. What we have got to do is find out what corruptions are still lurking in us and correct them. And as soon as we correct the mistakes in ourselves, we begin to see better values in other people, because we see in others usually what we are ourselves focused upon. So don't let the great big bad tube get you. Be very careful about it, and when uncertain, turn it off. And you'll find that if you turn it off to do something interesting, beautiful, or wonderful, you will never miss it again. You cannot turn it off successfully, however, until there is something you want to be or something you want to do right then and there that is more important than the tube. If you think it out that way, I think it'll work out all right in the end.